So first things, for me, maybe to bring across also how your personal investment portfolio looks like, we had a conversation about this already in the past.
Yes.
Can you share how your personal investment allocation looks like right now?
Well, right now, actually, it's... I think I mentioned to you back then that I'm quite heavy on crypto, right? So I've decreased that one quite a bit.
By default?
Well, I mean, like I said before, you don't lose until you sell. So what I've done is the ones that I bought at a, how would I say, at a lower price, and then with these little rallies that have had, so the money that has actually gotten out, I haven't reinvested in, because I'd expect it to go down still, maybe even quite a bit. Long term, I'm still a hodler, as you said, but yeah, I wouldn't put too much money back in there. Stocks I exited also, so now I still have some things that I can't exit again because they're so low, like Baba. That's a joke already between friends. Everybody bought Baba thinking it goes up. So anyway, so stocks I'm out. I'm still going to go back in, but I don't think this is the bottom. So anyway, no stocks at the moment. That's been turned to cash. Crypto down from previous allocation. Largest allocation is real estate. So actually, to the extent that I've even withdrawn from some of the P2P platforms, mainly income, because I have a few apartments lined up, which I already booked some time ago, and I need cash for that. So in that sense, it's more real estate heavy, and that's just because I think there's still room for valuation increase in Tallinn. Rental yields are relatively good, although the market is now turning down, but that doesn't mean that one should stop buying. So we're looking, but not as eagerly as before. So I'd say, if you have to give me numbers, I'd say 60% real estate, 20 crypto, 30 crypto, something like this.
20 crypto?
Yeah, maybe 20%.
And 30? 20% left then?
Yeah, maybe that's then the stocks that are in cash. Something along those lines. Rough allocation, let's say it's in this way.
Do you follow up a certain strategy with your investments? Are you a lot like cash flow oriented, or what's your approach?
Well, I keep them in buckets. My approach is that the real estate book is and of course in cash I can't count it now. If you go back to there, I counted the P2P part as well. So whatever you can put anywhere else, and I think most of it is going back into P2P and then stocks. But as a strategy, I'd say I keep them in separate buckets in my head. So the cash that's allocated for real estate doesn't go into crypto, however much I think that this is a great opportunity, or into stocks. So that's kind of a lower yield, steady, less risk, I would say. I keep it there. Crypto allocation is then again its own box. I consider that kind of a, money at risk in that sense, you could say even. And then the P2P / stocks, that's pretty much, at least the P2P part is cash flow. And that's where I usually keep the extra cash in terms of, like now, for example, I had, I think, almost 100,000 at one point in P2P. But now I've drawn it back to cut the interest, drawing it back, and then putting it into real estate. So it kind of acts as a cash parking lot in many ways. So. But yeah, real estate, obviously, out of those three is the best one in my head. Yields are lower, but in the long term, it also turns into cash flow. Pure cash flow, P2P is the best, obviously. Highest yields, very fast turnaround.
So you have no specific, it's all on cash flow, but it seems like you have a variety of investment ambition, so it's not everything like, I need to go cash flow, I want to go very conservative, or it sounds like you're very active in your strategy, changing, switching a lot, and just seeing where you currently see the best opportunities to make a good bargain.
Yeah, I don't have a long-term strategy as such that one would say, okay, my shares or stock book has to be a certain value at certain point. So no, I haven't drawn these kind of things. So real estate is the easiest in that sense that it's the most predictable. Now, of course, outside B2B, but let's say if you think of crypto, if you think of crypto and stocks, I'd say in real estate, if you have moderate loan to values, positive cash flow, then you will not end up in a place where you need to sell at a wrong time, then it's relatively safe. But of course, it shows in the yields, which are probably in Estonia, like rental yields, maybe 4 or 5% at the moment. So much lower than otherwise.
Do you track also your performance somehow of your investments? Not just isolated, but maybe like overall or?
Well, somebody says that you should always, like every morning, look at your bank account to know where you are. And I guess that includes also your crypto accounts and your real estate, so...
Or Singapore bank accounts.
Or Singapore bank accounts, or whatever bank accounts you may have, yes. So if you check them every morning, it's a reality check, in good or bad. So I track the performance, luckily in terms of the, you know, the real estate in Estonia. We spoke before about the Estonian corporate structure, company structure. It's relatively simple that you know, my accountant does a good job in terms of separating those assets. So I can just say, okay, you know, our book grew this much.
Of course, so you're investing also through your company?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or?
No, pretty much only through my company. So Estonian companies, yes. Has an obvious, as we discussed, obvious tax benefit. So it makes sense. So anyone who wants to get the Estonian, what is the
EU residency?
Yes, correct. So it's a good time.
Okay, so you are kind of for taking already your position on income, because I checked it again. You had like in April, you wrote about your investment portfolio on income, which back then was around 82,000 euro.
Yeah.
What happened to it in the meantime? Now you said you kind of withdrawing a bit to pile up for real estate.
I think the purchases. Balance today is roughly 20,000. I think that's about what there is in that sense. So yeah, I pulled out quite a bit in order to be. I have a few apartments which were booked some time ago, so I need to get the cash for the down payment. So that's where I. So that's why it's come down. I haven't had the chance to write yet the next. But there's actually, if you go back the blogs a little bit down like further down, there was a similar situation where I think I dropped from 50 to 30. There was another apartment that I built. So I think that's it's a really, like, it's a good parking place for cash. That's why.
No lack of trust.
Yeah.
And it comes quite handy then also to have short-term loans to liquidate fast and easily.
Exactly. Mm. No, and we can see it. I mean, clearly for investors, the big ledge when we look at it goes after 2 years. So if the loan maturity, and as we don't have the secondary market, then it's difficult for people to commit for longer. But obviously we see that 2 years is the where the interest drops off. 1 year is kind of still okay, but majority of investors are looking at less than 1 year, and probably that goes really to a few month loans. So you're right, the more attractive ones are the shorter loans.
Do you also invest on other platforms in the peer-to-peer space?
Yeah, I have an account on a few. Also
to test, obviously.
Yeah, to test. Yeah, I had big exposure on Mintos before, but I withdrew from there. Obviously, I mean, you know, if you don't use your own platform, then who does? So I withdrew from there. I've tried PeerBerry. I think they have a pretty simple, good system. I did a Estate Guru account, but they didn't have any good available projects at that point. So they're apparently selling out quite fast, so I forgot that. I did try Viventor as well. So
that means, if I have to go in there, it sounds like, so from a Estate Guru perspective, you're not the kind of, I diversify a lot throughout different projects, but you rather go into the details, be specific, and if you understand probably, they have a lot of Estonian projects as well, and you're kind of familiar, I think also Finland, they have a big exposure. And when you know a bit more the KPIs, so you are rather the guy that has a bigger investment and concentrates the investment.
I was thinking, I mean, like, as I said, it was quite a big allocation in real estate myself, like I said. then I was thinking that Estate Guru would be an interesting way to continue. It would also fit the profile of the company. But I never got to it because they really didn't have too many projects at that point, which I believe now has actually fixed itself. They've managed to onboard quite a bit of investment projects.
Hmm.
So I never got to it, but tried them. So not really using any other platforms at this point.
Hmm. But obviously the benefit obviously for you, like proper real estate investments, like the leverage that you have with your investment. How much share capital do you need to bring in for the projects that you're acquiring?
Banks are pretty conservative in Estonia. I'd say if you buy a home with a second mortgage, let's say you buy second home, an investment apartment, I'd assume you would get it with 10 to 15% down.
Mm.
If you want to buy a purely investment book, you need to bring between 30 and 40, I would say, which is quite substantial. That's Estonia. Finland is totally different, so Finland is probably around 10% down and extremely low interest rates as well. So in Finland, at least before the previous Euribor increases, I think somebody said that the margin from the bank is less than 1%, so it's practically free money if you consider inflation. But then again, you could see that in Finland now the prices started coming down, actually same in Estonia. But with the difference that I wouldn't call that Estonia to be in a credit bubble. So perhaps if the crash comes, it comes from different reasons than the banks having extended too much leverage. But yeah, leverage, it requires quite a bit of leverage. Quite a bit of own capital. Capital. Yeah.
Mm. No. Just a quick follow up here. Getting back to the platforms itself, I'll be curious, since you've experienced or covered also a few other platforms, which one would you feel comfortable having some bigger exposure outside of the testing phase if it wasn't for income?
I think Estate Guru is probably the one that I would go for, because there's they have still, let's call it, real collateral in terms of the real estate that they're backing. So if that analysis is done well, you should be relatively well off unless something tragic happens in the market. So I think again, one of the things why we started Income was the thinking that on many other platforms, you don't really invest in loans, right? So even if you invest in loans, somehow, funnily, your exposure is still to the balance sheet of the lender instead of actually buying a individual loan.
Mm.
So kind of in the same spirit, what we're trying to do is to have the loan book as a collateral, and real estate, Estate Guru is trying to do the same with the real estate. So I'm thinking that there at least has to be a trying of securing the investment somehow.
Mm.
Otherwise, it gets relatively risky. And that's why I would choose Estate Guru of those because of the real collateral they have.
Good answer that you didn't mention any direct competitor that is into consumer loans and bridge the collateral aspect now to your platform as well. Very smart. Let's talk about the topic that you and Estate Guru also have in common, lately at least. It's defaulted, or let's say late loans, that came up lately. So I checked also from your portfolio review last time, it was 82.3% of your portfolio that have been current. I know it's probably hard off the bat now to check, but what do you estimate where your current portfolio is right now?
Well, I checked, I mean, like in our case, what we've done, let's call it, I'll start from there. What we display is basically 1 to 30 days DPD, and then 30 to 60 DPD, and then buyback. So that's the normal statistics.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at anything that's late, even in the first bucket of 1 to 30 DPD, then obviously you get a different number, because most people pay late, but only by a few days. I mean, that's just it. Or the clearing happens later and so forth. But, you know, kind of in our, let's call it a in our attempt that trend at full transparency at the start. We said, okay, let's show those loans late which are late. So even if it's one day, we don't do any kind of pending payments or any kind of another bracket, and then investors can see what's actually late. Now, that has worked a little bit against us because obviously investors are worried. They're saying, hey, guys, you have like 80% is late. What's going on here? So we're saying, or I'm saying usually, guys, don't look at the first 1 to 30 day bucket. And that's actually now something we're discussing with the guys, is like, can we still put some sort of, I don't want to use pending payments because it has such a bad tone, mm-hmm. thanks to history, but perhaps to put the first bracket something like waiting for clearing, which would kind of give the, you know, 0 to 5 days, which either goes then to being late or actually goes back to current, instead of showing now everything late. So that's my kind of short intro to that. Now when I looked at it, because of investor feedback as well, somebody asked me by email just recently, and I looked at the overall book, and I think only 20% is at the 30 to 60 DPD bracket. So if you disregard the first bracket, which one should do, you'll end up to about 70-80% being current, which is relatively normal in, I would say, in consumer credit. Mm. So I'm personally not too worried about those late numbers. They look worse than what they are, partly because of our own, the way we display them.
Mm. Okay. From that point now, I can't hard check the numbers. I mean, you have the statistics on your webpage. I would personally assume the list of loans that are late 30 days and above is higher than, what do you say, like 20-30%, but rather like around 50%. But like from your impression, don't you feel like, is it just really, to your opinion and like how you argue, it's really like on a very small level, the delays that you have on very few days, maybe a couple of weeks. So you don't feel like there's a substantial increase in terms of late loans, because we see like from your first portfolio that you shared, like it was also possible to have 80% current.
Yes.
Now for the majority, it's between 20-30%. Well, so there is more late loans as a matter of fact. So where do you see the reasons for this? Is basically also,
well, I mean, there's two different structures that we have, right? So just to go a bit more in detail again, one structure is the normal assignment, right? Mm-hmm. So if you buy now today a Dana Rupiah loan or an ITF loan, you know, ITF places a loan on the platform and you buy through assignment direct commercial rights to that loan. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now if this loan is late, then it immediately shows there. And you know, the value of that loan can be €1,000 or €100 or whatever it may be. So that's kind of like a direct reflection of the book of the LO as such, which we've taken then into account in due diligence the same way, saying how much cash does the loan book generate, how much it should generate if there's a default, and so forth and so forth. So whatever is the, if we today we call the junior share, that's reflective of the quality of the book in many ways, you could say. And if we pass it, if we put it in the right place and we say, okay, we can accept that you guys have 30% always late, then that's reflected in there. So having 30% late of your book might be uncomfortable for investors, but perhaps it's part of their business model and the junior share actually fits in it. Okay, so that's the first model, is the direct assignment. The other model that we have is now, for example, or the other structure is like what we have for Vivus. So Vivus has Mexican loans, but what they do is so-called a business loan in between. So their, daughter entity or a parent entity gives a loan to Vivus in Mexico, and this loan is collateralized by a bunch of loans which are given in Mexico, those small loans. Mm-hmm. So that could be, you know, I don't know, right? You know, that could be 100 small loans in here, and it might be €5,000 in size, kind of like. So the value of the pledge, again, needs to go together with what we've determined to be the junior share part in that sense. So in simply put, there's no difference in terms of security with these two structures. But what's different is that if one of these business loans goes late and they're higher ticket size, if one of those is late, it doesn't actually necessarily mean that the book here is late. It just means that the loan originator is clearing it later or hasn't cleared it yet. Okay. So kind of you could think of it, I think Mintos back in the day had forward flow loans. So you can think of something like this, that it's basically a pool of loans which is packaged, but again covered by pledge of those little small rotating smaller loans. So looking at, for example, Vivus's loans, the business loans, they don't really give you a direct information of what's the book in Mexico like, right? So that's another thing which might distort it. We know that the investors hate seeing late loans, and that's something that we keep telling to the LOs, that can you please close this on time? You know, we do know that you guys will be eventually paying them before they go to buyback or at buyback, but don't let them go there because investors don't like it in general. So that's the kind of the message what we have to them. But so far, so good.
What's the situation now with Click Cash in Brazil? So I checked this morning, it was like 200,000 euros of loans that are either late, like in default, or later than 30 days already. No new supply of any loans. What happened there?
Click Cash is, yes, I mean, they've had some clearing issues. So looking to fix those, that's one thing. The other thing is they've been pretty much building a new scorecard and a new kind of product since, when did you say, April or something like this. So they haven't been listing. So we're just waiting for them to clear what they clear. And then when they restart issuing with the new loans, then we'll then start listing those. Now the problem is always, don't call it a problem, but let's say the issue is always that when we onboard a new LO, then we need to see the performance of the loans, right? So we analyze them. So when for example, let's say Dana Bishak made a new product change, Dana Rupia did a product change because of the local regulation, then we need to let them issue a few rounds of loans and then do the analysis to see how they performed. And then I would expect that once Click Cash restarts its business issuing with the new product, then essentially it will take a little bit of time for us to be able to list them. We'll need to take a look at what's the actual performance there.
So you're assuming they will be back at the platform at one point?
I assume they will be back, but probably somewhere next year, realistically.
And what's the timeline that you look at for the buyback? How's the communication line right now?
The communication line that they have there at the moment is that money is actually inbound. And they said that it will be cleared. That's the communication we have there.
Okay. But can you give a timeline or when?
It should come here next week.
Next week.
So that's what they said, that by next week they should be cleared. And then if it's not, then it's our first case of seeing how we manage in that situation, in that sense. Some people have even called for it, said that, hey, we see how well your things work when there's a first problem.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping we're not going to that, so remains to be seen.
Otherwise, it will be a good way to prove the effectiveness maybe of the junior share. Maybe you're also not too fancy enforcing it legally, right?
You could, but I think, it's always a thin thread, let's call it a thin line, when to pull the plug versus actually talking with them and finding the solution. So, but at this point, I trust that the cash is coming and we don't even need to have that discussion. So hopefully that goes as planned. That's what I've heard from them. So as of today, we're still on that thought.
On good terms.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about emerging markets. So when I reviewed the statistics, I saw you have around 125,000 euros that are defaulted right now. They're coming either from Brazil or Indonesia. Emerging markets, a topic you're having a very high exposure in those areas. What do you say are the benefits for investors investing into those markets?
Well, obviously, I mean, the benefit of if we look at emerging markets, well, we have their Vivus, right, from Mexico, you know.
Colombia
now, Juancho de Presta came in, and then Dana Rupia and Dana Bishak. Okay, those are two from Indonesia. Everybody seems to be Dana. I'd say, like, the good opportunity there is still that often these the very short-term loans are still acceptable in these countries in terms of regulation. It comes from pricing. It usually have APR caps, other things like you know, interest caps, and if you call it you know, if you call it payday lending, then that has pretty much been killed in Europe. Most of it is doing most of the good big players are doing installment loans, so you don't have any more of these shorter term loans available. And obviously, if they earn less on short-term loans, then the interest should be less also for the investor. So I think that the main, if you look at Dana Rupia and Dana Bishak, the main attraction there is the 3-month turnaround of the cash, which goes like pretty decently. That's their product. In Vibus's case, what the attraction is, I would say that it's part of DFI, which is a massive group in that sense. They have, I think, 20 countries, different operations of lending, very professional team, and they know their business. So those, I think, are the main attractions, is that usually these LOs can pay you more interest rates. What we did at the moment actually was we had a cap before at 12, right? And the logic of the cap, maybe you even have it in the questions, but or it as a discussion item, that the idea of the cap originally was that we want to stabilize the market by saying, okay guys, you can't do these tricks where just before you're about to blow up, you say we pay 20%, and then you would kind of catch the greedy investors and take them into a trap, which we have seen happening in some, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, we've seen it happen in the past. So we said that, okay, to keep stability of the market, let's put it at 12. It turned out that all of the LOs pretty much put the rate at 12. So now we just recently raised it to 15. And again, it looks like everybody put it almost at 15. So we don't still see this difference that, you know, is it a European or is it a emerging market LO? We don't see the kind of like risk reward if somebody considers it as a risk being in the emerging markets. Mm. So that we don't have today. It's pretty flat, because we see ITF offering at 15, and this Bulgarian, very established, you know, they're also on Bonster, I think. They're offering the same interest rate today as Dana Rupia. Mm. So the main difference comes actually from the product. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, but I'm kind of, you know, like seeing the pros and the cons. To me, the question evolves a bit like, is it a necessity for income to collaborate with partners in those markets, because you feel like the market in Europe is too regulated for short-term consumer loans, it's too saturated, and you know, it's like, where do you also see the future growth of the of income? Will it be partners from emerging markets? Will you focus on this, or do you see like the European economic area being also getting a bigger chunk in the future? So where do you want to fuel also that growth? Where do you see the...
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things is in Europe, definitely, it is getting saturated. It is being pressed by interest caps. So there's heavy regulation all around. And depending a little bit now on the loan books themselves, so if you have very established loan originators, you know, maybe I'll say in buy now, pay later space, for example, Esto, right? So maybe people know Esto from Minto's Estonian company doing buy now, pay later. I think they used to have on Minto's something around 7 or 8% what they were paying. And, you know, obviously in buy now, pay later, you will be then again being able to get perhaps even bank funding, which is even cheaper. So I think in Europe, once the companies get to a certain scale, they are bankable already, especially in buy now, pay later, credit card space and so forth. in those interest rates, and as I mentioned to you before, the funding cost is what they essentially look at it, because that's the, you know, that's the cost of their production.
Yeah.
So it becomes very difficult for us to compete in price with the other funding providers when we're talking about a European well-established. And at the same time, of course, the investors, it looks to me like retail investors today, they are still in the, you know, especially in this inflation environment, people are rather looking at it, okay, I want 12 or 15. Mm-hmm. And when we look at other platforms, you know, we saw, you know, increases. I think Mintos' highest today is 20, right? So when I looked at the other day. Mm-hmm. So kind of that kind of tells it that before, you could say 12 was a good interest or a high interest rate. Now it's perhaps it's 15, perhaps it's 20. And now if you have an established LO who used to get this money for 7 or 8, well, difficult to onboard them and promise retail money. So it's kind of a chicken and egg. So in that sense, I'd say, you know, there's a lot of potential in LATAM, like loads of potential. Mexico is growing fast. And they're doing good business there in terms of Vivos. You know, Colombia is a big one. Okay, they had an election. There's some political shift again to the left rather than to the right. Mm. I guess that's what goes with the emerging markets. Indonesia is trying to find its balance with regulation. So they've had two regulations already coming, one APR cap and now a different one. Mm. So I guess that's the thing. If investors want to get those 10 plus yields, we need to look at markets where it's possible long term. And also, if we are heading for a, you know, if we want to get to 100 million book or 200 million book, then essentially I think those markets, the emerging markets, are important in that as well.
Mm. Yeah, some platforms, they always try to play around a bit and try to balance supply, demand, and play a bit with the interest rate. Now, do you feel like, obviously, it sounds like you take a big pride in also having this double-digit yield and at least, you know, 10-12%. This is what investor wants. This is where you can guarantee good funding for the LOs of income. Do you feel like that's also the future path, or do you see, like, you know, scaling to a point where you feel like, okay, we, I don't know what Mintos did, like we make some different investment strategies, some packages for the more conservative investors, so you got more.
Yeah, well, I
of
mean,
those saturated funding lenders in your portfolio?
No, yeah, I'm thinking rather that, you know, the reason why we took this sort of a collateral approach, you know, trying to figure out what's the junior share and that the junior would always be behind the senior, mm-hmm. or under, you know, under the senior, kind of similar to what I mentioned to Estate Guru was that it's super difficult, even if we do the whole due diligence, it's super difficult to predict. I'm being very transparent here, to predict what can go wrong. You know, it might be regulation. Mm-hmm. It might be, you know, somebody getting, like, you know, you mentioned before, the was it Armenian who got pulled the license? You know, works. You know, there's a whole lot of things that can go wrong. You know, maybe the scoring fails, maybe operationally something goes off, maybe the economy collapses, you know, maybe the currency collapses. Mm-hmm. So you're all the time, it's very, so what I'm trying to say is we actually had a big discussion about how should we rank them, and should we have some kind of a star system, and you know that this is our top tier, A, mm-hmm. A low, and so forth. But we decided at the end against it, because we can't tell you, I mean, we can on a broad level, we can say this is better than the other.
I mean, the junior share kind of indicates how you assess the portfolio.
No, exactly. That indicates the kind of the quality of the book in that sense and other risks. So the higher it is, you could say it's, you could say that it needs to be higher for investors to be covered one to one. So even a lower junior share can say, okay, the book generates more cash and has less risks. So in one case, the junior share can be 10. In other case, it can be 50. But the end result is always that there should be one-to-one recovery to investors. But yes, you can, in a way, you can say that a higher junior share might have more risk factors in it, baked into it, or has a weaker portfolio behind it. Mm-hmm. But the end result would be still one-to-one recovery. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to go to start... grading, we didn't want to start saying, hey, this is a conservative strategy, or this is a risk strategy. I think investing in loans are all risk strategies in the end. And that risk can be mitigated then through trying to collateralize the book for the favor of the investors. Other than that, I'd say that the investors need to check it themselves, and that's what we're trying to do also, to have like give them enough information to understand and do the due diligence, what we do, to do it properly, so that we don't bring utter crap onto the platform. Because in the end, like you said, if somebody fails, then that's a test to the system. But then again, nobody wants to, even if you get all your money back in the end, nobody wants to be in a defaulted project. It doesn't matter if it's a real estate project or otherwise, people just don't like it, and then that's what we're trying to avoid.
One more follow-up question in regards to Indonesia. You got two LOs there. They make 68% of your total portfolio right now, so two-thirds. Which insights can you maybe share briefly about the Indonesian lending space, and maybe also what your personal link is to this country?
Okay. Well, yeah, my personal link is Bank Amar, or Amar Bank, which is an Indonesian regulated bank. I was one of the people founding it there in a joint venture with Toleram Group. So 5-6 years ago, I was there in Jakarta, kind of with the early stages of the bank. Quite fast it grew into self-sufficient, in that sense that it already had its own CEO and everything, and we were pretty much only knowledge providers in terms of scoring and data and systems and so forth, because of consumer credit background. So kind of we call it not a consultant, but a knowledge provider in that joint venture. So went through the ups and downs of the Indonesian market, learned a little bit about how harsh the regulation there can be, or strict. Fantastic market all in terms of size, you know, 250 million people. Demand for loans is there. I think it's like any other emerging market. In terms of running your business, some challenges, of course, in, you know, how you collect, how you get the papers to the borrowers and so forth. But all in all, let's say with the most important thing, a market where if you have a statistical scorecard, so like all lending and insuring is done through statistics these days, I mean, at least on a professional level. So you have big enough of a sample of people, and then you try to figure out which one of those pay you back, right? And you only try to give statistically those people who pay back. So the worst thing is if you don't have a modelable population, so they somehow act randomly and you can't make it work. So in Indonesia, the models work. They may not be very strong, but they work. And I think Bank Amar in itself, they listed in Jakarta Stock Exchange 2021 start. So in a way proves perhaps that this can be actually achieved. At the moment, the situation in Indonesia is that there was a lot of Chinese lenders coming. They called it helicopter money. They came in, even not even registering with the OJK, came in, set up shop.
OJK?
OJK is the local bank regulator. So OJK regulates both the fintechs, so mainly peer-to-peer platforms like both Dana Rupiah and Dana Visakar. And then they also regulate the banks, like Amaris. And really, there was a lot of this sort of a wild lending going on, not taking into account anything. And it's exactly the same what happens in Europe, or happened in Europe. Payday lenders pretty much taking a pee on all the rules and regulation and good taste. So that many of the Chinese lenders were doing the same. So OJK, and we've actually published some of it in our blog as well, some of the insights, but basically OJK took the stand now that they will not issue any new bank licenses. So there's a moratorium on bank licenses. And then there's also a moratorium on new fintech lender licenses.
Okay.
So they basically want to take the ones that there is now, they want to make sure that they all are okay, they're legit, and that they comply with the regulation. The latest change in the legislation, what they did was actually there was APR caps came, so that forced Dana Bicak and Dana Rupia to change their products a little bit.
At which rate?
It's still high. I can't remember the rate, but it's still high. But probably, you know, if it was 1,000 APR before for a 2 week loan, like your standard payday, then perhaps today it's 200 if you take it for 3 months. I mean APR. So they're still high, but significantly lower than what they were before. And then they also now, the latest regulation that came in there was that they want them to increase capital and to kind of be more solid in that sense. So first was limit the amount of new lenders coming in, then limit the profits they can make and the existing ones. And then now making sure that the existing ones are in a stronger place, more well capitalized and so forth. I guess those are the insights. And maybe the last insight is that, you know, for us Europeans, many are saying, well, this is usury. This is, you know, 200% APR is massive, that, you know, why would anybody borrow? But when you calculate APR, obviously that's how much you earn from the loan. You need to take into account how much you lose also of those, how many people don't pay you back. So if I say 30% of the loan book doesn't pay back, like you asked before, and if that's part of your business plan, then one could ask that, is it better then to leave the 70% without a loan or service the 70 and allow the 30 to default? Because in emerging markets, it's more about actually access to credit than the price of credit. So here
you have some numbers for how big the underbanking issue is, or how many people are underserved with funding.
Well, I should remember this one, but it is massively underbanked. I wouldn't be probably far off if I said that maybe 5% have a credit card, if that's what would help. It's a massive problem there. The same way. I mean, in Mexico, the same way. If you go to Africa, the same way. We don't have any LOs from Africa. We've had some chats, but at this point, not yet.
Is there just the last question on Indonesia? Now, the interest rate cap, how are the loan originators you work with? How do you evaluate the situation? Because usually when something like this comes into place, you see like, okay, all the small market players, they vanish from the scene. So that allows the bigger ones to gain bigger market shares despite being a slightly less profitable. So how is the, I don't know when this new regulation kicked in, but do you have some data how the LOs performed since then?
In terms of the way we do it is we first, when we do the due diligence part, the first part, that's the onboarding part. Now let's assume the product stays the same. We have about 6 to 9 months after the onboarding, we do another due dil, basically just to do a checkup, seeing how it's gone and is everything stable. Now in their case, we did take a look when they changed the products. And it looks like the origination is profitable and works as expected. So in that sense, I think for these two guys, there was no adverse effect. And judging from what we discussed with them, then business is doing well at this point. Dana Rupia is obviously, they're big, very big compared to Dana Bicak. But then even Dana Bicak, I just had a chat with the CEO asking like how it's going. Actually asked about the little mass of loans that is moving, edging towards buyback guarantee. And I asked, so how's that? Are you guys prepared for it? He said, yeah, we're prepared. We know it's going. That they had a little bit of more loans that went late in July. And then thus it's now that mass is moving forward. That's exactly the answer, you know, you would expect to hear. Yes, we know, and yes, we are prepared.
Best case scenario.
Best case scenario. You take one. You take it one step forward. Yes, we know. Yes, we're prepared. Yes, we executed.
We already invoiced. Okay, let's shift to the recent events. One you have been talking about already, the interest rate cap.
What we offer to investors.
now you allowed your lenders to go up to 15%. Maybe can you explain in general why you want to determine this interest cap in the first place? Why have you put it at 12%, and why do you don't want this to be an open market where the originators decide on how much they want to offer for funding?
So I originally, when we started, and we started building 2020 summer, I think we launched 2021 February. Mm-hmm. So almost 2 years soon that we've been active. Back then, world was obviously a bit different. You know, we didn't have a war in Ukraine, and inflation wasn't where it is today. So back then, coming from my previous position in a lending company, my hypothesis was that a decent loan originator should be able to get funding at around low double digit. You know, and that's including all fees, maybe high single digit. So you would say, 9-8, if it's an established solid business. So we said, okay, if we think that this is the case, we should cap the interest rates at 12. Was that now a smart move to put it at 12 and not to play on the greed of investors as a new platform? Probably not. We would have grown much faster if we would have said, hey guys, you get 20, if the LOs would have agreed to it. But kind of coming from an ideological point of view, we decided that it's 12. And that was to reflect the fact, yes, good LOs should get their funding at around 10, total cost of funding. Now, today we raised it at 15, or not today, but some time ago we raised it to 15 for the sake of really investors looking to more yield with the inflation rising and really having to compete with all the other opportunities that there are. So we said it's 15 now, and we still think it's moderate. It's much less than on other platforms. I can still say that also transparently. So we're still, let's call it the cheapest platform in that sense for the LOs, one of the cheapest. But then again, that needs to come because of the junior share part, right? So they get less leverage. You know, on Mintos you get 10% skin in the game, same LO with us might get 30% junior share. So essentially that's 90% versus 70% leverage. So we need to be the cheapest for them to be attractive.
Yeah,
and the reason was yeah, sorry, but what was I saying?
The basically question. So you got to the 50% mark now?
And your question was?
Like, why do you in general have this setup instead of having, let's say, the open market
Correct. Interest. No, exactly. That was the second part of the question that I forgot. It's to bring stability. And as I mentioned before as well, the main purpose is not to allow LOs freely to compete with the price. Means that they can't, if they are doing bad and they would be, you know, they don't have other liquidity or they're in trouble, they could be incentivized to say, I'll offer 20. And then there's two effects. One, investors will actually gravitate towards the 20 because they say, okay, in the end, we're all greedy. I want to get the highest. Hmm. And then what it does, it takes liquidity away from the better ones. And then the better ones are also inclined to raise, even if they wouldn't have any reason not to. So, you know, you have a business that's doing really well and is attracting money at 8. Suddenly you have a struggling business who says, oh, I want to get money at 20 because I need it, otherwise I'll go bust. It throws both things off. Mm. It puts investors at risk and it pisses off the investor or the better LOs. So that was the simple reason, just to bring stability and to avoid, let's call it tricking investors.
Mm. Makes sense. I think you mentioned already that almost every lender took advantage of this, right? And is now up to 15%.
Yes.
Does it also imply a bit that, let's say, that funding is drying out a bit for them, that they're really like in a need now to also go that way because they're not forced to? It's just like you cap it.
You can
still maintain it at 10, 12 as you had it before. Yep. So what's the the funding needs for your lending companies right now?
I think all of them are rather saying we want more than we want less in terms of funding. And it's really...
Why in these times? Is it a very high demand right now?
It's more of a market situation rather. Some of them have been on other platforms where liquidity is escaping, right? Mm. So some of them are saying that, we need to be on a growing platform. Mm. And that's why they're talking with us. Some have had other funding sources, like institutional funding sources, mm-hmm. which now, because of the war, have been either pulled back or renegotiated. Mm-hmm. So we heard from a few, especially being in the Baltics, where I don't really believe we are that much at risk. But some Baltics were saying, we're quite close to the border. Border is right next to us, to Russia. That basically it's risky, and many international investors pulled their term sheets back because they're looking at the region as being risky.
Just from the geographical
aspect, right? Okay. So that could affect, I think, and I think the same sentiment is overall in Europe, right? Investors don't know what's coming, and then they delay their own investments. Interest rates are rising, so everybody kind of is looking at the moment, where will this whole thing go? And I think the reason why DLOs are willing to pay more on all the platforms at the moment is because for them it's more important to get money instead of, not getting the money. Mm-hmm. The few percentage points is not that important for a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So it's rather a market conditions rather than seasonal demand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's switch to the junior share. We mentioned it already a couple of times. I feel like Income in general gets praised a lot about this innovative additional security mechanism, that additional layer. I think also on this channel, discussed already how it works, how it functions. Maybe you can talk a bit about the origin of it. When did you come up with the idea? What was the thought process behind?
Well, it's it's pretty much the same way as any institutional investor looks at it, right? So back in my previous life in a consumer lending company, this is how the deals would be structured. So essentially every loan, you would carry a part of equity as the loan originator in it. And then if something goes off, you lose that equity in favor of the investor. So that kind of acts as a buffer. And really... there is a lot, and buyback guarantee, I still have to say, it's the thing that makes P2P work, like really would work, that it insulates investors from basically bad loans. Mm-hmm. And then the thought process was that, okay, what needs to be the next mechanism that can then protect from actually losses if there's a default? Mm-hmm. And then actually the junior share came as we thought a lot about how to name it, and then we ended up with junior share. It's basically that it's used by everyone who invests professionally into loan companies. And the idea there is that it kind of acts as a skin in the game also, so that if the LO has in every loan 30%, 20%, 10%, mm-hmm. then they're aligned to do good decisions. But then also, if something goes off, then they will lose first everything, and only then the investors lose. Mm-hmm. So simply put, we copied from a playbook and tried to adapt it to P2P. Now, that being said, again, being transparent, different markets demand different structures. So the classical junior structure, what you would see in Europe, is probably something set up in Luxembourg, where the entity, the Luxembourg company, actually buys the loans and the borrowers pay back to the entity, mm-hmm. and that secures the full cash flow, and then it doesn't...
Is it like an SPV?
No, it's like an SPV structure, correct. Obviously, you can't do that in every jurisdiction. You can't do it in every market. There's market specifics on how to secure the book. So
don't you have SPVs in place?
We do have SPVs in place, but what I'm saying is that it's not always necessarily the same way in every jurisdiction. Europe is relatively homogeneous. It's easy. You take a Swedish loan originator, you took a, you know, Finnish one, or you take somebody from Spain. They can all pay to Luxembourg in euros, and you know, you can distribute the money there, and then even the borrowers can pay their direct, and then you just do your calculations and you return what you return to the LO. In our case, for example, in Vivus's case in Mexico, we have a pledge on the book, right? So there's a pledge on their loan book, and then we have the business loan structure, because the normal assignment would have gone too difficult. And wasn't binding as we would have liked. So it requires adaptation, but on a kind of ideological level, it doesn't matter which structure we use, there always needs to be this buffer element in every loan.
Okay. But still, like, even through that pledge, the, let's say, accessibility, maybe I'm not too deep into this legal kind of thing, but the accessibility of those funds is in a way guaranteed, or is it like you feel like it's a less secure structure than in a typical SPV?
Well, I mean, the most secure structure would obviously be an SPV buys the loans from the LO. Let's say in Europe, you buy the loan, you pay 70% of the nominal if 30% is the equity share. So you pay 70% cash to the LO, you get 100% to here.
Yeah.
And then the borrower, you buy the claim, the borrower keeps paying there. Whatever is there required for you to secure your investors, you take that out, the interest. So interest is coming down from there. And the rest, which is the profit part and the capital part of the 30%, that flows back to the loan originator, who then repeats the cycle, issues a loan, and puts the loan into the sales into the SPV. So this is the clearest, easiest, most secure when the borrower pays direct to the SPV. Now, in many jurisdictions and regulations, let's call it in Indonesia, for example, as these are both fintech platforms, they need to collect the funds from the borrower by the regulator. The regulator says, you know, if it's been funded through this fintech platform, the borrower cannot be made to pay to an SPV owned by Income. So the payment has to come to the platform, and then the platform sweeps it to us. We clear it, we take the allocation table, and we take the cash, we look at it, okay, this is the way it's been allocated, we mirror it in our system, and we pay our investors, and then we throw the rest of the cash back. And this is how the clearing works. So again, a little bit of a different system. And then in a pledge structure, essentially the LO issues loans, which have a certain book value in their accounting, and then this pledge, all of these loans are pledged toward the investors. So saying, if this loan, this business loan fails, you have the right to come after this pledge and say, hey, you know, these are actually our receivables. Now we are entitled to get the payment for them. And they obviously can't use those pledge receivables to take loans from anywhere else, because they're already earmarked to us in case there's a trouble. So just to highlight that it takes a little bit of creativity let's say it takes a custom solution for every market, which is of course costly and also time consuming. Ideally, you know, we could do everything in Europe, but that's ideally.
Maybe is that another downside, having like this emerging markets connections? And
absolutely, yeah.
Talking about the junior share, loan performance analysis, when you try to evaluate the cash value of the loan book, maybe in simple words, can you define how that is calculated?
I mean, it's a let's call it a cash flow coefficient. So there's a certain amount of cash that the loan book needs to produce in order to be able to service investors, right? So let's assume that, you know, you issue €1 million or you fund €1 million and there's 10% interest in a year, and the loan would be payable as a bullet in a year's time, let's assume. Then you would actually have 1.1 would be your required cash flow coefficient. So, and the cash flow coefficient is taken from a vintage analysis. So essentially we look at historical loan tapes saying in January 2021, you know, 1 million euros of loans were issued. How much of that came back and in what time? Was it 70%, 80%, 90%, you know, 100%, or maybe 120%? Then February 2021, March, April, May, June, and you'll end up with a table showing you these numbers of, you know, some percentages of how much cash came back from the book. Now, this is, of course, because it's already every monthly vintage already takes into account how much was not paid in, because that wasn't, because we're looking purely at cash, right?
Yeah.
So actually it takes into account already non-payers. Mm-hmm. So you can say that this is the amount of cash that comes in from the loan tape. So now if you say, okay, there's, you know, 1.1 is the cash flow coefficient that is coming money in from the book, and we say this is what's needed. So we need to get 1.1 million to the investors for them to be whole.
Yeah.
But then we say actually we put another 20% of, and that would be 1-to-1. So it creates 1.1 million and 1.1 million is what we need. And then you would say, okay, but maybe there are other risks there, like, you know, maybe COVID hasn't passed or whatever there was, and we put another minus 20 there. Mm-hmm. So we actually say, okay, 1.1 is needed, but 0.9 is expected.
Yeah.
And thus the cash flow, the junior share needs to cover this bit. So you'll end up with a 20% junior share because it needs to come from their own equity. So kind of you could say it's like loan to value, even if you look at real estate terms, how much do we borrow against, you know, against our own equity or their equity, sorry. So shortly put, I mean, I can show you later how it looks like, but that's shortly put how it works.
Mm. The risk margins that you deduct, now you said like for events like pandemic or borrower defaults or, I don't know, currency fluctuations or stuff like this. How do you evaluate this? I don't know, can you say like in simple terms, which coefficient you put against the performance one, and how do you like?
So we're quite strict on it, to be honest. Something that causes problems with DLOs, mainly because we need to compete with other platforms where they get, you know, 10% skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And I've said it, like it's super difficult to tell to someone that, hey, you're only getting 60% leverage, and they say, well, but I'm getting 90 over there. And then I'm saying like, then that's how it is. I mean, I can't help you with it. It is what it is. But in terms of the risk multipliers, we have a generic risk adjustment, which is roughly minus 20% what we take. So that's supposed to take into account the cost of collection, deterioration of the loan book in case we take it over. What happens if, you know, if the payers, borrowers say, well, we're not paying because it's no longer operational. No. We need to pay something to the collection company and there's cost. So there's a minus 20 roughly, which is the base risk margin that everyone has. Then in addition to that, like FX, like you mentioned already. Mm-hmm. So the books are too small to hedge at the moment. So I think it would be too costly. So FX margin is basically, our analyst takes a look at what is the historical fluctuation of the currency towards euro, and then we try to establish what could be the maximum that it could throw up or down, let's say within the period of what's the running time of the loans, right? So if it's a 2-year loans, what can we predict? Can it go up 10 or 20? But as you know, historic performance is not a guarantee of future behavior, or how was it, future performance?
Yeah.
Then obviously, you know, things like what happened in Turkey, these are like black swans, which are almost impossible to bake in. So in a way, under normal circumstances, you can predict, but if something totally, you know, unexpected happens like the pandemic, then you know you can't, that's a business risk you can't take into account, and an investment risk as well in that sense. But I'd say then you have about minus 10% might be the FX, so 20 for generic, 10 for FX. Then if there's missing data, but what I mean by missing data is that perhaps you know, there's not enough loan cycles. So if, you know, if we want to see 6 loan cycles, but the company has been operational for only 3 years and it's a 1 year loan, so you can only see 3 vintages or full vintages of yearly, then maybe we say, okay, just for to be sure, perhaps we'll need to add some additional margin there, and that could be in the ballpark of 10. When COVID was around, I think we put around 15 to Dana Bishak, Dana Rupia, somewhere around there. So quite strict, to be honest. But the idea is not to... The idea is always to be on the right level, right? So if we're too strict and the LOs don't like it, then, you know, we need to find a balance. So now when we're reviewing the Indonesian books next time, I believe that the COVID margins can be dropped. And that should be good news for them. But, you know, we'll see when the time for the analysis comes.
That's a good point, with balancing then also like the interest of the LOs. So do you feel like this is often like also an obstacle when reaching out to new lenders, that you're maybe too strict or too, I don't know, too tied up with your imaginations, how you want this to run?
Yeah, I mean it's a fair point, and I'm pretty happy with the panel we have, if we call it a panel of LOs now. So I'm pretty happy with the ones we have today. We've compound good balance with many of them, and you know, ITF being a very established one, you know, it was very nice to see them join us as well. But yeah, I mean we've had a lot of discussions with different LOs, and the pipeline was quite big. I think one or two have said, sorry, we are not, you know, not ready to pay that much, or we're not ready to accept that low leverage. To a few, we've said, no, thank you. You guys are too small or too risky, or, you know, the business model doesn't really resonate. There was one that was actually earning only on late fees, so that was what turned it positive. So we were like, yeah, it looks like you're cash positive, but it comes from the bad book, so we don't really, maybe that's not lending, it's a collection business perhaps more. So yeah, it's a discussion, right? It's a constant discussion, and surely it would be easier to be more lenient, and we'll try to be as much as we can.
What's your personal view on regulation in the lending business? Now we've seen a big wave of regulation taking place in your neighbor country here in Latvia. In general, like, you mostly operate with lenders that are more in a less regulated space. Now then there's obviously the company, the facilitating perspective for income. So what's your general view on regulation?
The general answer that everybody says is we welcome regulation, right? that's, you never hear anybody saying that, damn, this was a bad move for our business. No, so we generally we welcome regulation, right? So now we got that out of the way. A story of regulation, right? So if we look at Finland, regulation can be good or bad. And if we look at the story of Finland, where we're talking about lender regulation now, LO regulation, back in, I think, 2004, 5, something along this line, there was really no regulation. So it's, you know, payday loans were really booming, you know, 1,000 euro APR, you take 100 euros for 2 weeks, you pay back 120. In euro-wise, it's, you know, almost at these prices, a six-pack of beer. but in APR terms, usury. Quite costly. No, it's starting to be that. So, of course, regulators, politicians, media, everybody says this is horrible. Look at these interest rates. And they were comparing those interest rates with mortgages, saying like, how can it be that somebody pays 2% on mortgage but 1,000% on this loan, that this is poaching on the, you know, poor people and so forth. So they come up with their first set of regulation, and they put some sort of an interest cap on there, and what happens is the market moves to installment loans, and, you know, continues
the same with Latvia some years ago.
Yes, and the same continues. Now, instead of people failing at that point, with loans where the balance, when they go to actually the bailiff, you know, they go through the court system. At that point, people probably had about, you know, 5 or 10 of these loans when they blew up because of the short maturities and relatively, you know, low tickets. So they blew up when they had 1,000 euros of debt. Okay, fine. They went to go to bailiff, they went to court, they got the credit registry marking, they were out of the credit cycle until they grew up or got another job or something, and then they paid back the 1,000 with interest, done deal. Okay, comes the second leg of regulation, which is then, you know, people started turning to 1,000 euro, 2,000 euro loans. Again, after some shifting, they said, okay, again, you guys are charging too much. Now, all the loans which are under 2,000 have a 30% APR cap. What did the market do? The loan originators all started issuing loans of 2,001 euros. So now the same person who before went down with a 1,000 euro balance, now they collected 10 of these 2,000 euro loans, so now the balance is 20,000. So what does the regulator say? Oh my God, things are going horribly wrong, our people are getting more in debt, we need to do something. So they said, we put a 20% interest cap on everything. So it was no longer economically viable for anyone to keep these 2,000 euro loans, because you could only earn 400 out of that. You take customer acquisition cost is 150 already, credit losses, everything, you were on minus. But in euro to euro, what was the answer? You go to 10,000 euro loans, because then in 20% out of 10,000 euros is 2,000 euros. So now you can pay the 150 euros of customer acquisition cost. It fits in. So now the person who goes to bailiff on average in Finland owes 40,000 euros and will never be able to pay it. So that's a story of how regulation can move the market and actually make the problem worse. So my answer, the truthful answer to this is that market has a funny way of putting itself into place. The excesses should be cut. You know, there clearly there were excesses in the market, like, you know, where people were given loans that couldn't pay them back. So those you can cut off. But in the end, there's no worse business than giving loans to people who can't pay back. So the market, if it's left to operate, I think it has a tendency of fixing itself. So cut the excesses, but let the market operate. And then, you know, people will have, everybody has access to different kinds of loan products that they have. So I'd say that's my short, perhaps a little bit Estonianized way of looking at it, that the market is always right.
And you're welcoming the regulation.
But I welcome regulation. but the problem is that many times, you know, the regulators, they don't want to listen, or they just don't listen. And by no means, they are not experts in the business. So that's the problem. They're regulating something they don't understand.
Yeah, but where do you feel like is the issue coming from? Because is it like, because obviously it's always twofold. You need to see like people being underbanked, like what do you do with people that don't have access to alternative finance or loans or stuff. So where does the misconception come? Is it like, where's the narrative of, we know we need to have a really strictly regulated environment to the point where there's, you know, it doesn't make sense for the economy also then to drive? And
well, I think it comes from the narrative comes that one thing is that every single one of these regulators is bankable. So I don't think they can even imagine the situation where they wouldn't be able to go to their home bank. And you know, then you hear these comments, the same with the journalist, you hear this, that it's horrible. And I followed the discussion for 10 years. So it's like, it's horrible. Why don't these people take a loan from their own home bank at 8%?
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, your home bank gives you 8% only because your home is as a collateral there.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you a non-collateral loan for that. So somebody who doesn't have any money, doesn't have a home to collateralize, they don't get that loan. So you end up exactly in this place. So I think one of the problems there is that they come from a different reality, the one to people who are addressing it, trying to protect, but then at the same time cutting people out of the credit possibilities in general. And then it's politically, of course, it's an easy mission. Hey, we want to give everybody free credit, or like, these are too expensive, so we're kind of saving people.
Yeah.
But statistical lending would suggest that if one cohort of customers is not profitable, then you just cut it out. and this is exactly what's happening. You only give higher ticket loans to those who can pay, possibly, and then the underbanked will be even more so. That's how it goes.
Do you see, like, how would you judge, like, this ethical debate on consumer loans, you know, when we go to this area of, is it really, like, the excesses and the really high APRs that are maybe somewhere unkept, or where it's really, like, taking advantage of those people, or, you know, like, where do you draw the line, you know, like, do you make, do you have a thought about this?
Well, I mean, I think the problem there is probably, I'd start from the thing is, obviously, you shouldn't give loans to people where, you know, it makes your situation much worse. So that's what I'm thinking is, like, in a way, in if you think about today in Europe, will an additional credit card improve your life at all? Probably makes it worse. Whereas in Indonesia, yes, the interest of the card or the product is much higher, but can it improve your life? Yes, but then that depends on the way the person is using it. So two different things. But if you look at purely in Europe, ethically speaking, you know the lender should probably take a look at, you know, what is the theoretical ability of the person to pay back. So admittedly, loans were granted too easily before. For example, in Finland, and in many times the collection income was also calculated in your model. So you would be saying, you know, especially in the payday loans where we never went, you would say that if with the high fees and everything, if I can collect one, then it actually covers for three who lost. So the fees were that high. So obviously this you could say is on the, you know, unethical part. So it's a balance. I think, you know, the problem was that the unethical players drove the regulation in. It doesn't matter what the few good apples do if there's a few who actually end up in the news with, you know, I gave too excessive credit there. And then the other problem is that not putting everything on the loan companies, the other problem is that people blatantly lie about their income, right? So they take loans without even intention to pay back. You know, they take loans from 20 places but only tell that I only have one loan. So I remember our scorecard was, funnily enough, in our scorecard there was a data point, how many other loans you have, and it was based on the customers. We didn't have a positive credit registry back then in Finland. So we couldn't check it from anywhere, but the answer zero other loans was the highest minus you could get on the scorecard, because we knew that the person is lying. You know, 99%. But my mother didn't have any loans at that time, so she asked me, could I get a loan from you? I said, no, we think you would have lied at when you said you have no other loans, because everybody has. So actually, from a statistical perspective, the people lie, and people lie consistently. So that's a good thing about, if you think that, you know, the way you lie is unique. No, it's not. All the others lie exactly the same as you do. So you can't put the whole thing on the LOs.
But these days, through credit bureaus, data...
That's a good solution, right? So I think a positive credit registry and as much data as possible to the loan companies is amazingly good solution. As much as you can give.
Otherwise, you just throw in a dart in the black or...
Correct. I mean, and every additional piece of data they have is an additional data point. And that means that they can do better decisions. So, for example, in Finland, they made it back in, again, you know, I know the market pretty well, but back in, I think, like 2008 or something, 9, 10, they decided that part of the population registry data is only allowed to licensed banks. So they cut some of these specialty lenders off the data.
Yeah.
And then they're wondering, why are these guys making worse decisions? So kind of, you know, it's obvious.
I think something similar happened in Slovakia or something.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, exactly. So again, thinking like, do better decisions, but do it blindly is kind of... No. So I think in modern world, data is really the key. In some emerging markets in Africa, even in Brazil, Mexico, they're also trying to get a little bit of the telephone data to see what's your telephone profile like. and that could help. But you know, the age of privacy is kind of here, so Google, in a funny way, age of privacy. I mean, Google knows everything about you, but doesn't want you to stamp table. They don't want to share it with anyone.
Yeah.
So.
But on a similar note, I think also other platforms have said they use social media data, or how you move there, or just like on the application side for the loan, like how you put maybe the articles, the tool, how much you really need for the loan, and what is the amount and the time you spend on there. They kind of try to utilize all those data points and try to figure out the profile. You know?
It's true. They do. I'd say that a lot of it is marketing for investors. In the end, I mean, the data that you get from a first time borrower, right? So you only have what you can get from the registers, and that's relatively weak. But where it gets very strong, the data is then when you do repeat past customers, and you can see in our case also with some LOs, we have a lower. Junior share on the repeat borrowers because obviously the profile of the repeat borrowers in terms of how much cash they generate is much higher. So what's most important data is how the person behaves in terms of payments, because then you kind of find the kind of person. I mean, there's always people who can't pay, but the more important is the question, is this the kind of person who will pay if they can? There's a whole lot of people who want the money, but they won't pay and they don't want to pay. So, behavioral data is the most important. All the little, is it a capital A or a B? Well, maybe it gives you a little improvement, but not too much.
Yeah. Rather than those soft aspects. But it got me to a very interesting point, because when I was thinking about the access to data points, what I also heard, like back then, and maybe it's just specific markets, but maybe you can share it from your insights, that sometimes the regulator is really having a very close bond, let's say, with the more traditional banks and allowing them to have a better access to evaluate credit risk. Whereas the non-bank lenders, they have more difficulties, as we just discussed. That there's also some sort of a lobby that really from the regulator side, you know, what's the right word to...
No, affecting...
That advantages basically those kind of traditional banks and tries to keep the non-banking industry a bit out from the bigger picture and wants them to... Not get them into the right move to serve the underbanked and people that need credit.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, the banks have a long, how would I say, relationship with the regulators usually, and obviously, with that comes some sort of ability to affect. And then, in a funny way, in the discussion, banks are always excluded. By kind of like banks good, fintech bad. So it's kind of baked in the discussion already that if you're a non-bank lender, you're doing payday, and they call them, everything is payday in Finland, even if it's 10,000 euros for 20 years, it's still called payday. Who, maybe payday comes then in 20 years time. So I think that's already the split there, that a regulated bank is somehow perceived as a better option, mainly due to they have this fantastic 1% 2% interest rates what they offer for mortgages, so they have to be cheap, that's the thing. But then if you take your a 100,000 euro mortgage for 25 years, 2% interest, in 25 years you pay 400,000 back, right? If you take a payday loan, 100 euros, pay 120 back, your APR was 1,000 APR. Which one is more likely to kill you? The extra 200,000 you paid to the bank for the 2%, or the 20 euros you paid for that? So these comparisons and such are not very, very good. APR is a good comparison, but it's not a very good comparison talking about two different types of products, so you should kind of classify. But these get all blended and mixed in the discussion, and I think that's why the banks have such a big kind of, we are responsible, we are regulated, we've always being here, and these challengers are kind of the upstarts who just poach on people or whatever you may call it, but and surely there is a lot of lobby. I'm 100% sure about it.
Yeah. Well, to close the bigger topic of regulation, we took a big bow now on this. what's your personal prediction for income in terms of regulation?
So we are registered in Estonia, and we will be regulated at one point. At the moment, there was the EU-wide regulation, crowdfunding regulation that came into force. And the problem with this regulation...
It's not really for your business model, is it?
Correct. So the problem with it is that it takes into account crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding and real estate crowdfunding very well, mm-hmm. but it doesn't take the sort of marketplace lending at all into form. What we understood was that the regulator in Estonia was penning it down. We saw some drafts that was already at the start of last year. And while we're following it, we haven't heard what's coming. So essentially, we can't apply today because there's nothing to apply for. When the crowdfunding regulation is finally in the local law, then we can apply for the license. And that's what we will have to do at that point. And we will do. Talking about what's coming in the regulation itself, the most interesting part is probably buyback guarantee. So maybe somebody has gotten burned as a regulator, I don't know. But that was something that's very interesting, that they're saying that there might be changes to how this should be organized, that it shouldn't be maybe the LO buying them back. It might be that the platform should somehow collect the pool as like a sort of a insurance fund or something mm-hmm. from the LOs as it goes. And I think it comes from the fact that it failed so miserably on some platforms that when they've been, you know, collecting investor feedback, then the general sentiment that buyback guarantee is bad or doesn't work, and that's a thing that needs to be addressed. So that was one thing. And then the other thing there was really conflict of interest. So that's an interesting part. I'd like to see what happens then with these platforms that fund their own loans. So like, you know, if you're issuing the loan as well as collecting the funds, then are you allowed to use those public funds for your own personal gain? That's an interesting discussion that will come. Mm. And I think there's a few platforms in Estonia already kind of with a similar structure that might be affected. But again, too early to speculate. We'll wait to see what comes.
So earliest you expect some movement next year then?
We were hoping by the end of this year, but next year hopefully regulated. Hopefully, why I say hopefully, it is that it makes life much easier with the banks and with all the cooperation partners. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you use money transfer services, if you use banks, whatever you do, everybody always asks, are you regulated? And we say, well, unfortunately, no. In this sense, we welcome regulation. So, again.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
To cover off maybe now our conversation, lastly, but finances, future growth.
Yes.
What's the financial state of the company right now?
At the moment, we are still burning cash. We're supported by shareholders at the moment. And we will be going for another funding round now to probably still this year. We're already having some initial discussions. So essentially, yeah, moving forward, there is runway support from the investors, but we would really like to raise more funding in order to be able to reach faster the break-even. And as we said, break-even is roughly, with current cost base, I would say we're at 30-40 million euros outstanding. So today we are about 5.5, and we're growing, I would say, 1 million a month. So one would say that, and if one thinks that growth will actually accelerate with scale, then one would assume that we get close to break even by the end of next year. That's kind of like a realistic assessment of where we are. Plan is to get first there, and secondly, of course, I mean, our original plan was to, if Mintos was at half a billion, we said, well, surely we can take like, you know, half of it. So let's see if we can. I mean, that requires obviously good LOs that can absorb. I think today, yeah, shortly before I let you continue, shortly I would say there's
you take over the portfolio
Shortly there's like, I'd say there's about 20-30 million that we could absorb with the current LOs for sure. It's just a matter of investors finding us and kind of, you know, continuing to use us, and then we'll get there.
Yeah, that covers pretty much all the smaller aspects I had still on the, on the table. Like, okay, overhead costs of the company. I'm not sure, like you said, like with the current overhead costs or the expenses you have, you would reach break even at 40-50 million, but who knows when you scale, maybe not too big from the staff perspective, but maybe also expenses for marketing, customer acquisition costs, IT, things that will change that you would need to then also improve your service.
IT in that sense, I mean, we have a few things that need to be, maybe that's worth saying, few things which we budgeted. You know, secondary market is roughly like 20,000 maybe to get in, if you talk in euro terms, just to give scale to people. The most expensive part of the platform with current development costs was actually the ledger, meaning the underlying ledger, the system, and the base, the product in itself, mobile app, and all of that. Now that that has been put in place, the IT cost is not so much. So we're looking at it more like, okay, we have upkeep, we need to get the new LOs, API connections, and manage the old ones. And then, yeah, these little visual changes, what I mentioned, you know, the different brackets of DPDs to change those, secondary market, perhaps ability to invest with the junior share. But these are, I would say, any a bit bigger development is roughly 20,000 would be, you know, as an approximate cost. Marketing, clearly one of the largest cost items. The beauty of marketing is, of course, that, and I'm not saying we're doing it, but at some point, as that takes a lot of the profit off, then if you cut that cost item way off in the future at some point, then obviously you're easier in break even. But in the end, nobody wants to stop growth. So, and I think that goes for the investors as well. So,
And the publishers.
And the publishers, correct, correct. So we know how much pain that causes then when suddenly somebody says and pulls the plug. So it's not in the, at least in the cards in the next, in the foreseeable future. But it's just nice to say that and to see what is the theoretical opportunity to switch to operationally profitable. I mean that's roughly what it is. Overhead costs otherwise are not so big. We have about what we mentioned, 7 people plus IT partly outsourced, so we're not that big of a team.
Lastly, I have to put my finger slightly in the wound because I was reviewing your business plan from about a year ago.
Yes.
I was quite impressed that you still made a calculation that the forecast of profitability is still in plan for the end of next year. I feel like considering the growth numbers you had this year, it seems like a bit off. So just like from investment perspective, you forecasted 75 million by the end of this year. Now you're at 18. Number of investors, 20,000, 3.5, 3.7. Number of loan originators, okay, it depends. But I feel like overall the bottom line, before I let you have the word.
Please.
Obviously, I think the major key here is you need new investors because obviously that comes then with new investments and that brings then also new originators because that's having then the liquidity that they need to do business with you. So it all starts with the investors. Now you're fairly behind from the ideas you had a year ago. So what's your idea to attract new investors?
I mean, the main thing for us, first of all, absolutely right. We did the last round that we started in April 2021, and I think the projections are from there pretty much. Lots have changed in the world since then, to be honest. So, you know, things didn't exactly go as it was planned. That was one of the reasons why we actually decided not to take the Cedars money in. So if you remember, we were on Cedars, so we had a long discussion with them on it, and I said personally that, you know, those guys committed to do the investment at certain assumptions. You know, those assumptions are what you just mentioned. We are not there. So, you know, it took them 6 months to get to clearing point from the closing of the campaign.
So what was it? 350,000 or
I think they raised about 150. So
you give it back then, or
we never downloaded. So basically, we ended up with saying, like, guys, they said, you know, we can do disclosures, and that could have been one way of solving it. Mm-hmm. But I said, like, again, still look at this world where we're at now, that I don't feel too comfortable taking that cash in, you know, because equity valuations are lower at the moment. Do we need to do a down round? I don't know. But if you look at Klarna, they came down from, what, 40 billion to 7 billion valuation in a matter of a year. So one would assume that the valuations today are not what the investors expected when they committed. No. That being said, a lot of has changed on the world. So I think in terms of, yes, we are behind on what we thought would happen. Second time in history. First time when we started, we thought that, well, you know, we can easily grab 10% of the largest player with the junior share idea. That didn't happen. So I guess it's a constant evaluation of where you are and adjusting. How do we attract those investors? I think, you know, by cooperating with you guys. Yeah, but like this, right, correct? Yeah. So no, I mean, because it's clearly put, it's such a niche. P2P is still in a way a niche where, at least for us, Facebook advertising and Google advertising is sort of like somebody coming on the street and tapping you and then saying, hey, give me your money and I'll invest it for you. You know, you'd be like, what the hell? You know, I'm not going to give you anything. So essentially, that's why we with the team, we pretty much decided that we'll focus on things like this. You know, talking with investors through you guys, the publishers, trying to give a fair and transparent picture of what's going on. And then really, today we know that every month brings us a million more in investments, at least. So we know that eventually we will get to where we want to be. And that's really the way we're doing it. I don't know. I mean, there's another aspect which is interesting. If you look at PeerBerry's growth after COVID from 20 to 90 million in a matter of 9 months. So for personally, I'm hoping that there's a hockey stick hidden somewhere, which actually kind of breaks the bank in that sense that people will say, okay, you know, that's an alternative to all the other platforms. We want to bring the money there, and then we start moving faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting parallel, because ultimately, I think PeerBerry has been a bit on an upshift prior to the pandemic, but I feel like especially pandemic and a few months of uncertainty and the way they handled in this crisis environment proved, okay, look, they seem like really legit, stable business, and that I feel like this event fueled the growth even more. So it's maybe a matter of sustaining a certain crisis or to gain the momentum.
Maybe, oh, you're correct. Or maybe it's just the thing that by that they got on the map of every investor, right? So, you know, if people start talking, hey, what about PeerBerry? What about this? Do you think I'm going to lose my money? Even that's publicity. Hmm. Somebody marks it down and says, hey, you know, oh, such a platform. Oh, this guy didn't lose his money. I'm going to go there. And then he tells the others. So perhaps there is a place where the hockey stick starts. But today's growth is already pretty good. Not good enough, but pretty good. And that's what we try to at least keep up.
Personally, when I look at the numbers, I feel like comparing that you're still quite new to the business. Yeah. I feel like it's very good numbers, but obviously it always makes it look very small when you see like the kind of forecast you kind of had. So it's like, it's tough then you can always lose when you put up too high expectations or feel like, okay, we conquer the world and everything. It makes you then look what happened at the end.
Yeah.
Rather than, but what is the alternative? Going small and being like very conservative? No, of course you need to satisfy also the investors you try to lure in into seeders and tell them,
and I think
become a shareholder. They don't want to do this with a very super conservative plan of profitability in 10x years. And
correct. I mean, and coming from Finland, I think like I have a problem with storytelling a little bit. So I could be much more, you know, promising more. But it's probably not in our nature. The thing is, especially with early projections that you make, and I think it doesn't matter what business you have, right? So are you starting a cafe? Are you starting a P2P platform? Are you starting a consumer lender? Your first projections that you've drawn on paper or wherever, they're astronomical always, you know, because otherwise you wouldn't start that business.
Yeah.
If you thought it's going to be a long, slow grind, you know, to in 5 years' time you'll see the light, you would never start it. So of course your pizza place or cafeteria or P2P platform, it has to go from 0 to 100 in a matter of 2 years.
Of course.
So that's the, let's call it the entrepreneurial enthusiasm and maybe a learning as well, that things might not go as you expect at first. So.
And in the end, people always hold it against you.
But then I had a friend who said also this way, I mean, I'm not here to fail, but a friend said that, well, in a startup, he said that, well, if this doesn't work, I'll do something else. Mm. So, you know, kind of a healthy dose of, healthy dose of realism as well, that any venture can go well or bad. We, of course, do our best that it goes well.
Mm. Okay, great. Maybe one last question. Personally, I perceive you as being very enthusiastic in general about the peer-to-peer lending space and this kind of environment. What do you say? Where does it come from?
It probably comes from the history that I've had in lending. I've done it for pretty much my whole life, so 14, 15 years already in just on the lender side, right? So started, I think, 2004, fresh out of school, and pretty much ended with the Amar exit, and then with the idea of, you know, I had a, you know, kind of idea came that, hey, let's try something else, let's do a P2P platform or an investment platform, that's something that solves the problems of investors and also the LOs. So I think it comes from there. But also the fact that people generally are very seldom, they're not told the truth about how lending works, you know, and what are the drivers behind it, and as if people are interested, then I'm more than happy to talk, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the question, well, why do those guys earn 200% and the investors only go 12? I was asked in one seminar, and I've seen it several times. Mm-hmm. And the simple answer is that the 200% is, there's a whole lot of things that goes into it. Actually, you know, you get 12%, maybe the lender's bottom line is 5. But, you know, that's how it is. So anyway, happy to clarify. I think that's where the enthusiasm comes from, to teach people a little bit about the life of a loan shark or a or a bank lender or whatever you wanna call it.
Okay, great. Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.